It's nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you all for hosting me. It's a lovely place. I can't help remembering Catherine and feeling some gratitude and joy at what she's left here, this amazing practice place for you all. And it's a great honor to be invited here. As I was walking up to the mat, I realized that I didn't have any jokes in my talk. And I don't know any jokes to, like, you know, monk walks into a bar or something. So I'm sorry about that in advance. And I do think this is maybe kind of a serious talk. It doesn't have a lot of jokes. It may not be particularly entertaining. And I'm also not sure that it's... tell you how to live your life. You know, there's this maybe some of you have experienced from that side of the seat, the temptation on the part of the person sitting in the seat to tell you how to live your life. It's a great temptation. It seems like it's not totally uncalled for. The feeling that, yeah, I think all of us would be happy to have somebody tell us how to live our life. But at the moment, I'm feeling remarkably unqualified to tell anybody how to live their life. And since I don't have a particularly entertaining talk either, then I feel like, well, all that's left is maybe to invite you all into my own process, some thinking I've been doing that hopefully will make sense and will speak to your life. And that hopefully there will be time for you to help me think through some of these issues that have been on my mind lately. So there's a few different things that I wanted to bring up, and I wanted to see if they hold together or not, if they come together for you in the way that they seem to be coming together somewhere at the deeper levels of my own mind about these basically three kind of related topics that I wanted to raise. So just, Kokyo, thank you for the introduction. So my name is Jiryu, and Kokyo said some people might be interested in knowing what I'm doing over at UC Berkeley. Doing Buddhist studies, and what I found is that a lot of it is language study. So I'm doing a lot of study of language. And there's the promise that eventually I'll be reading all kinds of Buddhist texts in Japanese and Chinese, but there's also quite a bit of slog to be expected, a lot of quizzes and vocabulary charts. So I say I'm doing Buddhist studies, and I am being exposed to a lot of wonderful Buddhist scholars and wonderful Buddhist material. And I hope that somehow that study I'm doing comes back and influences my understanding of the practice, and I'm noticing some of the ways that it already has. So if people have any questions about that path of study, I'm happy to talk more about that at the end. So the first thing I wanted to raise is related actually to a book that I've been reading that maybe some of you have heard of. It's called Radical Hope by a guy, I think his name is Jonathan Lear. And it's about the Crow Indian people, American Indians, right around the time of their, you could say the end of their traditional culture. So as they were at this moment where the Crow were being, basically their culture was being annihilated by the U.S. government and the white man, This book is a kind of exploration of one chief in particular, maybe the last traditional Crow chief, Plenty Coupes, and his understanding, his response to this kind of major change. So there was this sense at the time, before the culture was kind of completely destroyed, there were kind of the signs of it. The buffalo were decreasing, and there was this kind of anxiety in the tribe. And as a young man, maybe nine years old, I think he had one dream at 9 years old and another dream at 12 years old. This future great leader, Plenty Coupes, was able to, as Lear puts it, kind of dream this anxiety. So he was able to, in dreams, kind of give a shape to what was so far just a kind of sort of unspecified but seemed like profound anxiety in his tribe at the time. And his dreams showed him that the buffalo were basically going and weren't going to come back. Which seems like a very hard thing to admit for those people at that time. It was a very hard thing to grasp and to open to welcome and to admit. And various people resisted it in various ways. But at least according to this author of this one particular book, Plenty Coupes, by having kind of the certainty of this dream, by totally coming to terms with the fact that the whole world was changing completely, by totally accepting that, he was able to act in really kind of dynamic and creative and interesting ways that that allowed room, that opened some space for these Crow people to create kind of new way of understanding themselves and new ways of having meaningful life in this new situation. So the question in this book is kind of, how do you move forward into something that is completely unknown, right? They could recognize that everything was changing completely. And some people tried to hold on to the prior value system, the prior kind of world and sources of meaning and kinds of understanding of the world that they had previously had, tried to hold on to those and meet this change with those ways. And then some people, like Plenty Coupes, were able to create radically new ways of understanding how to be in a new world. Actually, the teaching that he received in this dream was to listen like the chickadee listens, rather than to bring the old into a time that no longer supported the kind of the basic context of the old, to listen to the new and to find something in the new. So anyway, this has been a very rich study for me. I think it's, you know, the book is called Radical Hope, and it is a very ultimately inspiring kind of account of somebody meeting change. But it is also, it's heavy, you know, to consider the loss of a culture. And I feel like, I think what's clear in the existence of this book, and when I read it at least, and in my thinking about it, I feel very close to this kind of anxiety that we have in our time too, this sense that not quite sure what's going to happen, but it seems less and less buffalo, you know? This sense of basically this anxiety in our time, this sense of this unsustainable civilization. And I don't know if anyone has really dreamed this well, you know, and I'm not sure what it would be for us to dream this anxiety, to give it some kind of shape so that it's a kind of unknown that we're moving into that is clear in some way. I think part of this anxiety may just be the basic anxiety of human life, which the Buddha diagnosed a while ago, which is that everything's going to change, and we have trouble with that. And sometimes it's easy to see, you know, you look back in history and there's various, seems like, lately it really seems like every few years or less, you know, the end of the world is coming, you know, it was going to be December 2012, right? It was going to end. And then a couple years back in May, it was going to end. And various people in throughout history in this country and also in China, actually Chinese Buddhists got into this as well as Taoists, this kind of every now and then being pretty sure that the world is going to end really, really soon. So, and I've always thought in a way that it's kind of the easy way out, you know. It's very dramatic, it's very exciting, the world's going to end tomorrow, everything's very alive or something. But it's kind of easier than, oh, or my alarm's going to ring, you know, and I'm going to have another day with these people and in this life, you know, the sort of what's actually scarier, that it's just going to go on for a long time or that it's going to suddenly end. What is it, Suzuki Roshi in Samsishin saying, you know, this pain you're having now, everybody thought, you know, there's all these teachings of impermanence, so you have some pain and don't, you know, it's going to change, it's going to change. And him saying, you know, this pain you're having now is going to last a very, very long time. I don't know if I'm on the bandwagon of the world is about to end, but I do feel that there is some anxiety that we have now that has to do with some sense that things may be changing in some, that ahead of us is some change that's so profound that we can't actually conceive of what it is. And that's very much the situation that the crow are in, according to this author, that basically their possibilities, they understood the possibility of failure, so, and they were very battle-oriented tribe. So according to Lear, their sense of the possibilities were there will be battles, and either we'll win the battles or we'll lose the battles, essentially. And that kind of was the possibility set for their future, you know. And then to have something come in that's actually neither of those, that just means that whole, that basically takes away the meaning of that whole duality, that whole set of possibilities is no longer describes reality. So it's been really interesting for me to think of what is it for me, and maybe for us as a culture or a civilization, what is it that we assume so deeply and build our lives kind of so faithfully on without even noticing, you know, that we think, especially if some of us, you know, Buddhists, maybe think we have very flexible minds. Maybe. Or we aspire to have flexible minds. But it seems like, you know, this ground that I'm finding my ground on, this life that I'm living, the way that I'm, say, mindfulness or some practice I'm doing is so deep down that no matter what kind of concepts were challenged or what ways of understanding the world were forced to change, I would still have access to that. So I've been wondering if that's true, and wondering, you know, how you can look, you can't look from inside some system of understanding the world. You can't look past it. But you can dream, I think, and you can definitely feel anxious about the vulnerability of this system, you know? My whole way of understanding the world is kind of vulnerable, you know? So how deep can my roots go, my roots of practice, and my roots of presence, my roots of being alive, how deep can they go such that things, everything could change in even in ways that are now totally inconceivable. Everything could change, and I would still have some way of understanding and fulfilling my life and my humanity. So that's one thought I've had. One issue that's been a lot on my mind. There's anxiety and there's also anger, you know, that gets close for me. When I allow myself to feel this anger about profound, or this anxiety about profound change, then right there is this kind of anger at others for letting it happen, or for causing it to happen. I don't know if that resonates with any of you, but I feel like, you know, our civilization is unsustainable, and that makes me angry at somebody, or at everybody, at all of us, and at me, but it's at somebody in particular. You know, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's Obama or something. There must be somebody, you know, to blame for the world. So this anxiety and this anger, and this sense that something's not right with the world. That I can't quite be at home here because things are off, and that makes me anxious and it makes me a little bit angry because this world was supposed to be my home and I was supposed to be able to be at home here. But it turns out that I'm not able to rely on it. And that makes me mad because that shouldn't be the case. And it should be fixable, and then I should be fixing it. So I'm mad at myself also for not fixing it. So welcome to my mind, everybody. Thank you for sitting so quietly and attentively. And I realize here, I think I have about 4 Dharma talks here, but so I will, I vow to not pass 7:30. But I do want to raise up something that's actually Buddhist, a Buddhist teaching, that I don't entirely understand. I raised this teaching recently, not too long ago at Green Gulch, and then afterwards some people were asking me like what it meant, and I realized there's an assumption when you offer, you know, you take the seat and then you offer Buddhist teaching, there's an assumption that you understand that teaching. So that was difficult to explain to the person who was asking me about the teaching, that I didn't actually understand it, but I really appreciate it. So I want to share this teaching that I appreciate, of this old Chinese Buddhist school called the Three Stages sect, the Sanje Jiao. Maybe about 6th, 7th century China. Everybody at the time, the kind of popular thing in Buddhism at the time was that, and there were definitely some people running around saying that the world was ending, but even the people who weren't felt like it was in really bad shape. That the people had people's capacity to understand Buddha, to understand the Dharma, and to wake up to the Dharma was greatly diminished. You know, in the old days there was the Buddha, and the Buddha was able to understand reality and be liberated. But people today, just look at us. You know, we're in no condition to understand, to really become enlightened and understand reality. So maybe some of you have heard of Mapo, the kind of the decline of the Dharma. So it becomes this very, actually kind of like a very creative force. It's sort of like, oh, the Dharma's declining, none of us have the capacity anymore, what should we do now? And people thought about all great kinds of things like just sit and stuff. So these people of this particular sect took this idea of the of our lowered capacity really far, to the extent that they said, you know, people today, anything that they think it's true. They grasp their views, and that kind of grasp views are false views. Basically, people today have false views, and that's all they have, is false views. It's sort of like anyone who says they're right is wrong, you know. So people today are always saying they're right, and that's evidence of how very wrong they are. Because in this day and age, we can't actually understand the truth. So another way they said it is that all beings today, you know, especially kids nowadays, people nowadays are blind from birth. We're not able to see reality. And then the corollary to that is we're all blind from birth, and so then the founder of this sect says, don't give weapons to the blind. So we're blind in that we just can't see reality. So don't give weapons to the blind basically means, the way I see it, any view that we pick up, given our basic incapacity to really like grasp the truth, any view we have about the truth we're just gonna end up kind of hitting other people with. And I think we see that a lot with our own views and with other people's views. Fundamentally, you know, I don't know what's true, but I have some view, and now I'm going to hit you with it, you know. So their approach was to, they said, well, why don't we just take everything as true? So rather than carving up the world into the things that we think are true and the things that we think are false, and only kind of appreciating the true and throwing out the false, why don't we just appreciate everything and take everything as true? The sense was that kind of Buddha is around, but we don't really know where, you know? So why don't we just take everything as Buddha, and that way we're covered, you know? If we start rejecting some things, saying that's not Buddha, but our view is already false because we're just these limited, tiny, confused people, then how could we say that's Buddha and that's not Buddha? Chances are the thing we say is not one of the many things we say is not Buddha is going to turn out to be Buddha. And then we'll have missed it. So So instead of just taking refuge in the Buddha the way that we usually take refuge in the Buddha, which is kind of like I take refuge in the Buddha that I think is true, and I don't take refuge in the Buddha that I think is false. Does that make sense to people? When I take refuge in Buddha, I have some idea about what that Buddha is, and I think that's kind of true. And I take refuge in that, the good and the pure and the peaceful and the calm and the compassionate and the wise. And then all the stuff that's not that, I most certainly do not take refuge in. So they say, but we can't really do that, you know, unless we're totally clear seeing, how do we really know what's true? And what's compassionate and what's wise. So let's take refuge universally. Let's take refuge in the universal Buddha. So they understood that universal Buddha as having a few aspects. One of the pieces of that universal Buddha, the Buddha that's actually worthy of taking refuge in, part of that is the good, true, wise Buddha that we understand. And then another part of that is the false, evil Buddha. So they had this practice of taking refuge in the false Buddha, in the evil Buddha. They take refuge in all of the true teachings of the Buddha, and then they take refuge in all of the false teachings. All of the Buddhas who teach the wrong views and the wrong practices, the evil Buddhas, and also of the Dharma. They take refuge, you know, in the teaching. We think, you know, Dharma gates are numberless and I vow to enter them. You know, all of these teachings, refuge in the Dharma means all of these good teachings of Buddhism. And these people practicing this tradition certainly did that. They took refuge in all of the wonderful sutras and all of the wonderful teachings. And then they also took refuge in the teachings of the greatest evils. And they took refuge in the teachings that subvert the good. And they took refuge in all of the secular teachings and the teachings of all of the wrong views. And then naturally they took refuge in Sangha universally too. So they took refuge in all of the good people in the Sangha, and they especially took refuge in all of the evil, not so good people in the Sangha, which is maybe the most encouraging part of their practice. They had this great test, actually, which is very exciting to me. They were very generous, actually. That there was a great expression of compassion in this school. And Donna was a very big, you know, charity donations were a very big a deal for them. And they said, you know, if you're going to give some money to a temple, you should first ask if there are any practitioners in the temple who break their vows. It seems like a reasonable thing to do, right? You want to support a pure Sangha. So if you're going to donate to a temple, you want to know that it's a place of purity, a place of real refuge, where there's not people breaking their vows. So you should ask, is there anyone here who breaks their vows? And if they say, no, there's no one here who breaks their vows, then you should not give them money, because that means they're excluding people from their understanding of Sangha. They're saying, these people who are doing good according to our view of good are Sangha, and we're keeping out the evil people. But a real universal, if it was a Sangha that really understood this kind of universal refuge, then they would freely admit that there were many in the Sangha who were breaking their vows. And then you would know it was a Sangha worthy of offerings. So as I got into this, you know, what is this, like, refuge in evil? I started finding some other teachings. There's this strange Tiantai Buddhist teaching on the doctrine of inherent, all-pervading evil. So maybe some of you have heard of Buddha nature, this good Buddha nature that pervades everywhere. A certain branch of Tiantai Buddhism accepted that. There's Buddha nature, and then there's the all-pervading evil nature of existence. And this statement, this Tiantai statement, that other than the devil, there is no Buddha, and other than the Buddha, there is no devil. So this kind of opening of a view of refuge and a view of what Buddhism is that totally includes and even embraces evil. Which evil, you know, then people wonder what evil is. And I think for me it's just evil. I'm not so concerned with evil, like what is evil mean, so much as evil for me means all of that which I reject, right? Which I, like, justifiably reject. Evil is that which I justifiably reject. And these teachings are sort of like pointing to a kind of including into my refuge and into my vision of the world in a very profound way, including that, even that which I would justifiably reject. Another way this is expressed in In tantric Buddhism is this very strange kind of tantric practices of including these taboo, sort of embracing taboo. So there's this one practice of the five ambrosias and the five meats. Maybe some of you have heard of this. So basically you have Buddhist practitioners cultivating the good and the pure and very concerned about what's pure and what's good and very concerned about staying clean of that which is impure and not good. And then this teaching comes along where there's all of these rituals, prescribed rituals, where you consume these taboo meats. I mean, meat already is impure, right? But there's the meat of beef, dog, elephant, horse, and human. So these kind of ritual teachings on taking into yourself these things that you, again, here, justifiably reject, you know. And the five nectars, the five ambrosias are feces, urine, blood, semen, and marrow. So it seems like there's this, you know, that kind of tantric esoteric practice is a whole separate issue, you know, and the question of kind of does anybody actually do this, and, you know, in history, has anyone actually engaged in these rituals? It's kind of an open question, you know. I think often it's done sort of ritually. You ritually do the ritual of consuming these things as sort of preserving actually the our very natural disgust and aversion to these things. But as a kind of symbol for total inclusion and in a way for radical kind of non-duality of good and evil, of pure and impure, you know, these teachings are very powerful, and also kind of disturbing, and also feel really important to me. And this is kind of what I'm exploring, particularly in light of this question of how deep is my ground, you know? How deep is my ground? And then finding the points where I feel like I start to kind of run out, you know? I get to kind of the edge of what I feel I can include in my refuge, or include kind of with ease and joy and peace. How much can I include? How big a world can I include? And these teachings are like poking right in there, you know? They're saying, well, how about this? How about this, you know? Can you include this in your understanding, in your ground, you know? So the last thing I'll say is it's just an attempt to understand around a particular word that I've been thinking a lot about, understand kind of how what these teachings have in common, or how they might make sense to me, and where I might find this kind of ground that I feel like I really need, and I feel like maybe we all need. And that's this word. You know, the question of what do all these things, good and evil, and pure and impure, have in common, you know? That's actually worthy of veneration and a worthy place for refuge and a worthy and reliable ground for a person. And the word that I come to is life. So I'm very interested in this word life lately, because it seems like it's hard to find the edge of it, you know. It's hard to kind of run out of life. We do run out of life. We all know that, I think, very deeply, that life seems to end. But I think it's obvious, too, that life, fundamentally, life essentially, is kind of isn't exactly just the opposite of death. You know, there's the life that's the opposite of death, and then there's just kind of like life that includes life and includes death and includes everything, really. You know, I think it's if you start thinking about life, or as I've continued to think about life, it's hard for me to find something that's not alive. And I don't know if if this, again, if this makes sense or if people can relate to this, but if you look at basically anything that's appearing in your life, how could something that's happening not be life or not be alive in some basic way, you know? I'm alive, or this thing that's happening we sometimes choose to call life. If I see a rock, you know, how could I say that that rock is not life? It's totally appearing. It's finding existence in my life. It's totally participating in my life. I also really appreciate the sense that life is already here. I think Buddha, when we take refuge in Buddha, we can still hold out for that Buddha will come later. Buddha is something to get to. Buddha is other than what's happening now. Particularly if you're facing evil, or if you're facing aversion or disgust, Buddha is elsewhere than that. But life, it's not a big special thing. You know, it's life special. You know, it's amazing. It's inconceivable. It's complete wonder through and through. But it's not really special. It's hard to like get a lot of energy around like, I'm going to find my life. You know, we do that to Buddha. People really want to find Buddha because we think that Buddha is outside somewhere. But life is like, I guess we can try to clarify our life or try to find our life or something, but it's a little, it becomes quickly ridiculous, you know, because we already are alive. And I think most of us are, we can be clear that we can't, it's not like, if I practice right, I'm going to have more life. And if I practice wrong, I'm going to have less life, you know? Or, you know, we may think in Zazen, some periods of Zazen have more Buddha and less Buddha, you know? Some of us actually think that way. I actually think that way. But I don't actually think that any moment of Zazen has more life than any other moment of life, than any other moment, you know? Or that any person has more life, and I definitely say that person has more Buddha than that other person. But life somehow is profound and mysterious and all-pervading, and is also equal, kind of equally everywhere. So this, and the Sanjay Jiao, you know, the three stages sect is more or less clear about this, that they can take refuge in evil because they understand its essence, you know. And its essence is that it is, you know? And they can wholeheartedly venerate the isness or the lifeness of all things, you know? Most of the time we see something evil or we see something disgusting, we take justifiable offense and justifiably exclude something. But we're missing an opportunity to enter life there. There is life there. In all of that that I reject, there is life there. And if I take refuge in life, if I'm committed to completely meeting life and being intimate with life and totally being alive and including life completely, then to find every piece of life and totally honor it as life. So I guess one of the ways that I think about this is that so when the three stages sect takes refuge in all of the true and false teachings, I think it's not that all statements or all teachings are true, but all statements are true expressions of true life. And then to take refuge in evil, it's not that all acts are good, but that all acts are good expressions of true life. So there's nothing that's not completely expressing life, and I take refuge in life, so I take refuge in all things. without being confused by the expression that it's taking, the form that it's taking. And of course with people, that all people, as we know, are not right. People are not all right, but all people are right expressions of this true life. Yeah. And what would it be to totally live that? I think it would kind of have this feeling of taking refuge in evil and of consuming that which is taboo, totally including beyond the lines that we usually draw. And I guess I feel like we maybe have to insofar as the lines that we draw are vulnerable. So we do have a few minutes left. I'd be very curious and happy to hear any of your thoughts on this. I'm grateful to have the chance to share it with you, and sorry if it has the feeling of Guy trying to think through some stuff he hasn't worked out quite. But anyway, thank you for participating in that. I really value the space of practice together to look deeply at these kinds of questions, however clumsily or impossibly. So are there any thoughts?
There's something in Rai that seems like so at the center of everything you're investigating that I don't understand. And that is what you really mean by taking refuge or finding ground. Mm. Because there are words that make sense to me, like opening to, including this, totality of life. Mm. But I don't understand taking refuge anyway, in any sense. It's just like a big question to me what that is. So could you talk a little bit about what you mean by that, by taking refuge in evil,
yes,
false teachings, true teachings,
Yeah. I think of refuge as kind of where do I go for shelter and stability and safety and security and wisdom and protection. Where do I go for nourishment and support and safety and sanity and where's home? And I think what I'm exploring is how can I have the widest possible view of what that home is, So I can imagine this refuge as this, refuge in the Zendo. That's so beautiful. That's so true for so many of us, that this place is refuge and we're safe here and we can open and we can find our protection and our wisdom and our sanity. But what is refuge when I'm faced with something that's a lot messier than that, So, yeah.
Would it be correct to say the exploration, part of your exploration is actually finding safety that it doesn't exclude anything, feeling complete ground and safety without excluding anything?
Or if my refuge is something that has any kind of boundaries around it, then chances are sometime I'm going to be in some situation where it's not there. And then I don't have refuge. One image I've used is that people, we talk about refuge as a shield sometimes. I don't like that image so much, shield. But it's helpful in that you need to have a shield with you for it to work, So kind of Buddha has to be there if you're going to take refuge in Buddha in any given moment, So, but what if I can't find Buddha and all I see is evil or aversion? then what if I could take refuge there and find there my nourishment and support and stability there? Then I could be at home in the world. I could be at home wherever I am, wherever I go, without like withdrawing into some Buddhist state inside myself or going to some Zendo or something. So I think in the Mahayana and Buddhism generally, kind of like widening out that view of what that refuge, while keeping its positive quality, you know, like, no, this really, I really do mean a place of stability and ground and clarity and ease, but can I make that place bigger and bigger? No. Thank you.
And that's.
I think the sense of like ready, you know, there's these like transition councils, I'm sure there's one in Santa Cruz, but kind of ready, you know, are we ready? I guess that like there's fear and there's anxiety and there's fighting, and then there's just being ready and open to, you know, to change, to inconceivable change. And that just seems like an important piece, the readiness, not like, you know, barrels of water in the basement or something, although that's, but just ready, you know, for things to change in ways that are inconceivable. That's what's kind of so illuminating about the crow example. Like at the base is like change that makes our whole understanding, this thing that Plenty Coop said is after, nothing happened after the white man came. Basically their whole way of understanding what it was even for something to happen. It's like that deep, just as a kind of pointer, and, you know, I don't know what that means, and I don't think the author of this book knows what that means, really, but just that it's that deep, that change could happen so deep that we would even say, and then things stopped happening. And then could we still have refuge, you know, could we still, so cultivating that and exploring that, you know. Oh yeah, I'm open to change, you know, but how deep change? And in a way, you know, whatever happens to the world, our own death is that, you know. So, I think.
Biologically, this is a really odd thing. And we're doing things farming that I've never done before. Never mowed the cover crop, then irrigated, then spaded it. I found myself yesterday afternoon just relaxing at the end of the day because we found some response that seemed to take care of the soil. But I was very anxious beforehand of, I don't know if this is going to be the right thing to do, but I'm feeling 4 acres of soil taken care of. I felt like I could relax.
Thank you. That's a great example.
Gone to the older generation to find their way in the world, to find wisdom and understanding.
generation, not the older generation, has disappeared from our culture. Mm. The younger generation appears to have a strong belief that the older generation can offer anything.
Mm.
And I feel it is very interesting how the younger generation will create values and principles that I think is very difficult for younger people. They have to find their way on their own because our culture does not support a rite of passage.
Thank you.
I'd like to know how the pro-adopted or adapted post-civilization, what was their
I do recommend the book. It's a little, I found it very powerful. It's called Radical Hope. And it's not that they thrived, you know. But this author Lear feels that they were able to have a realistic approach, which actually ended up involving working with the United States government, which was, this author makes it very clear that that's not kind of what he thinks was so great about what they did. You know, like, hey, they got on the team, you know. It's very much not that. But to understand the newness of the time and fully let go of the past. Work with the new situation rather than fight against the new situation once it was clear. Once the situation was clear, you know. One of the things he talks about is other... basically, how courage, you could fulfill your humanity by manifesting courage, but people were continuing to try to manifest courage in a way that didn't make any sense in this new time. And so then we're doing this kind of empty, kind of like violent violence that in a prior world system would have meant courage, but given the totality of this change, no longer meant courage, no longer meant anything. And so he kind of saw a different way. There's an interesting piece too about how he understood spirituality, and some people got very into doing this dance that was gonna, by dancing this spirit, then the white man was gonna go away. And that for this author Lear is an example of not facing reality and using spirituality to not face reality, instead of to use spirituality to face reality, which is what Plenty Coups did in this dream that was very, very spiritual and was given to him by the deities, but was using the spirituality and the deities to really accept and open to the new reality rather than to kind of hide out in them and hope that they were going to take care of all of this for us. He does make the case that they, you know, they got a little more land and their culture was preserved. It seems like a lot of the tribal identities were blended in a way, and the Crow were able to maintain a little bit more of a cultural identity and more land and stuff. So kind of pragmatic. But how... you know, incredible for somebody to totally move on, you know, somebody that so much part of a prior world to say and to teach the younger people and to teach everybody, this is done, don't look back. And even, you know, till his last days being very strict, about kind of non-nostalgia, you know. So. So I've broken a vow. So please donate to this temple. Thank you. Thank you very much. May our practice here somehow include and benefit all beings everywhere.
Thank you.